This is disc number 6.
Inspired by this new approach to things, he discovers that he has at last found the courage to contact the future Mrs. Blue. But when he picks up the phone and dials her number, there is no answer. This is a disappointment, but he remains undaunted. "I'll try again some other time," he says, "sometime soon." The days continue to pass. Once again, Blue falls into step with Black, perhaps even more harmoniously than before. In doing so, he discovers the inherent paradox of his situation. For the closer he feels to Black, the less he finds it necessary to think about him. In other words, the more deeply entangled he becomes, the freer he is. What bogs him down is not involvement, but separation. For it is only when Black seems to drift away from him that he must go out looking for him. And this takes time and effort, not to speak of struggle. At those moments when he feels closest to Black, however, he can even begin to lead the semblance of an independent life. At first, he is not very daring in what he allows himself to do, but even so, he considers it a kind of triumph, almost an act of bravery. Going outside, for example, and walking up and down the block. Small as it might be, this gesture fills him with happiness, and as he moves back and forth along Orange Street in the lovely spring weather, he is glad to be alive in a way he has not felt in years. At one end, there is a view of the river, the harbor, the Manhattan skyline, the bridges. Blue finds all this beautiful, and on some days, he even allows himself to sit for several minutes on one of the benches and look out at the boats. In the other direction, there is the church, and sometimes Blue goes to the small grassy yard to sit for a while, studying the bronze statue of Henry Ward Beecher. Two slaves are holding on to Beecher's legs, as though begging him to help them, to make them free at last. And in the brick wall behind, there is a porcelain relief of Abraham Lincoln. Blue cannot help but feel inspired by these images, and each time he comes to the churchyard, his head fills with noble thoughts about the dignity of man. Little by little, he becomes more bold in his strayings from Black. It is 1947, the year that Jackie Robinson breaks in with the Dodgers, and Blue follows his progress closely, remembering the churchyard and knowing there is more to it than just baseball. One bright Tuesday afternoon in May, he decides to make an excursion to Ebbets Field, and as he leaves Black behind in his room on Orange Street, hunched over his desk as usual with his pen and papers, he feels no cause for worry, secure in the fact that everything will be exactly the same when he returns. He rides the subway, rubs shoulders with the crowd, feels himself lunging towards a sense of the moment. As he takes his seat at the ballpark, he is struck by the sharp clarity of the colors around him. The green grass, the brown dirt, the white ball, the blue sky above. Each thing is distinct from every other thing, wholly separate and defined, and the geometric simplicity of the pattern impresses Blue with its force. Watching the game, he finds it difficult to take his eyes off Robinson, lured constantly by the blackness of the man's face, and he thinks it must take courage to do what he is doing, to be alone like that in front of so many strangers, with half of them no doubt wishing him to be dead. As the game moves along, Blue finds himself cheering whatever Robinson does, and when the black man steals a base in the third inning, he rises to his feet, and later, in the seventh, when Robinson doubles off the wall and left, he actually pounds the back of the man next to him for joy. The Dodgers pull it out in the ninth with a sacrifice fly, and as Blue shuffles off with the rest of the crowd and makes his way home, it occurs to him that Black did not cross his mind even once. But ball games are only the beginning. On certain nights, when it is clear to Blue that Black will not be going anywhere, he slips out to a bar not far away for a beer or two, enjoying the conversations he sometimes has with the bartender, whose name is Red, and who bears an uncanny resemblance to Green, the bartender from the Gray case so long ago. A blousy tart named Violet, is often there, and once or twice Blue gets her tipsy enough to get invited back to her place around the corner. He knows that she likes him well enough because she never makes him pay for it, but he also knows that it has nothing to do with love. She calls him honey, and her flesh is soft and ample, but whenever she has one drink too many, she begins to cry. And then Blue has to console her, and he secretly wonders if it's worth the trouble. His guilt towards the future Mrs. Blue is scant, however, for he justifies these sessions with Violet by comparing himself to a soldier at war in another country. Every man needs a little comfort, especially when his number could be up tomorrow. And besides, he isn't made of stone, he says to himself. More often than not, however, Blue will bypass the bar and go to the movie theater several blocks away. With summer coming on now and the heat beginning to hover uncomfortably in his little room, it's refreshing to be able to sit in the cool theater and watch the feature show. Blue is fond of the movies, not only for the stories they tell and the beautiful women he can see in them, but for the darkness of the theater itself. The way the pictures on the screen are somehow like the thoughts inside his head whenever he closes his eyes. He is more or less indifferent to the kinds of movies he sees, whether comedies or dramas, for example, or whether the film is shot in black and white or in color. But he has a particular weakness for movies about detectives, since there is a natural connection, and he is always gripped by these stories more than by others. During this period, he sees a number of such movies and enjoys them all. Lady in the Lake, Fallen Angel, Dark Passage, Body and Soul, Ride the Pink Horse, Desperate, and so on. But for Blue, there is one that stands out from the rest, and he likes it so much that he actually goes back the next night to see it again. It's called Out of the Past, and it stars Robert Mitchum as an ex-private eye who is trying to build a new life for himself in a small town under an assumed name. He has a girlfriend, a sweet country girl named Anne, and runs a gas station with the help of a deaf and dumb boy, Jimmy, who is firmly devoted to him. But the past catches up with Mitchum, and there's little he can do about it. Years ago, he had been hired to look for Jane Greer, the mistress of gangster Kirk Douglas, but once he found her, they fell in love and ran off together to live in secret. One thing led to another. Money was stolen, a murder was committed, and eventually Mitchum came to his senses and left Greer, finally understanding the depth of her corruption. Now he is being blackmailed by Douglas and Greer into committing a crime, which itself is merely a setup, for once he figures out what is happening, he sees that they are planning to frame him for another murder. A complicated story unfolds, with Mitchum desperately trying to extricate himself from the trap. At one point, he returns to the small town where he lives, tells Anne that he's innocent, and again persuades her of his love. But it's really too late, and Mitchum knows it. Towards the end, he manages to convince Douglas to turn in Greer for the murder she committed. But at that moment, Greer enters the room, calmly takes out a gun, and kills Douglas. She tells Mitchum that they belong to each other, and he, fatalistic to the last, appears to go along. They decide to escape the country together, but as Greer goes to pack her bag, Mitchum picks up the phone and calls the police. They get into the car and drive off, but soon they come to a police roadblock. Greer, seeing that she's been double-crossed, pulls a gun from her bag and shoots Mitchum. The police then open fire on the car, and Greer is killed as well. After that, there's one last scene. The next morning, back in the small town of Bridgeport, Jimmy is sitting on a bench outside the gas station, and Anne walks over and sits down beside him. "Tell me one thing, Jimmy," she says. "I've got to know this one thing. Was he running away with her or not?" The boy thinks for a moment, trying to decide between truth and kindness. Is it more important to preserve his friend's good name or to spare the girl? All this happens in no more than an instant. Looking into the girl's eyes, he nods his head, as if to say yes, He was in love with Greer, after all. Anne pats Jimmy's arm and thanks him, then walks off to her former boyfriend, a straight-arrow local policeman who always despised Mitchum. Jimmy looks up at the gas station sign with Mitchum's name on it, gives a little salute of friendship, and then turns away and walks down the road. He is the only one who knows the truth, and he will never tell. For the next few days, Blue goes over this story many times in his head. It's a good thing, he decides, that the movie ends with the deaf-mute boy. The secret is buried, and Mitchum will remain an outsider, even in death. His ambition was simple enough, to become a normal citizen in a normal American town, to marry the girl next door, to live a quiet life. It's strange, Blue thinks, that the new name Mitchum chooses for himself is Jeff Bailey. This is remarkably close to the name of another character in a movie he saw the previous year with the future Mrs. Blue, George Bailey, played by James Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. That story was also about small-town America, but from the opposite point of view, the frustrations of a man who spends his whole life trying to escape. But in the end, he comes to understand that his life has been a good one, that he has done the right thing all along. Mitchum's Bailey would no doubt like to be the same man as Stewart's Bailey. But in his case, the name is false, a product of wishful thinking. His real name is Markham, or as Blue sounds it out to himself, Mark Him. And that is the whole point. He has been marked by the past, and once that happens, nothing can be done about it. Something happens, Blue thinks, and then it goes on happening forever. It can never be changed, can never be otherwise. Blue begins to be haunted by this thought, for he sees it as a kind of warning, a message delivered up from within himself. And try as he does to push it away, the darkness of this thought does not leave him. One night, therefore, Blue finally turns to his copy of Walden. The time has come, he says to himself, and if he doesn't make an effort now, he knows that he never will. But the book is not a simple business. As Blue begins to read, he feels as though he is entering an alien world, trudging through swamps and brambles, hoisting himself up gloomy screes and treacherous cliffs. He feels like a prisoner on a forced march, and his only thought is to escape. He is bored by Thoreau's words and finds it difficult to concentrate. Whole chapters go by, and when he comes to the end of them, he realizes that he has not retained a thing. Why would anyone want to go off and live alone in the woods? What's all this about planting beans and not drinking coffee or eating meat? Why all these interminable descriptions of birds? Blue thought that he was going to get a story, or at least something like a story. But this is no more than blather, an endless harangue about nothing at all. It would be unfair to blame him, however. Blue has never read much of anything except newspapers and magazines and an occasional adventure novel when he was a boy. Even experienced and sophisticated readers have been known to have trouble with Walden, and no less a figure than Emerson once wrote in his journal that reading Thoreau made him feel nervous and wretched. To Blue's credit, he does not give up. The next day he begins again, and this second go-through is somewhat less rocky than the first. In the third chapter, he comes across a sentence that finally says something to him. Books must be read as deliberately and reservedly as they were written. And suddenly, he understands that the trick is to go slowly, more slowly than he has ever gone with words before. This helps to some extent, and certain passages begin to grow clear. The business about clothes in the beginning, the battle between the red ants and the black ants, the argument against work. But Blue still finds it painful, and though he grudgingly admits that Thoreau is perhaps not as stupid as he thought, he begins to resent Black for putting him through this torture. What he does not know is that were he to find the patience to read the book in the spirit in which it asks to be read, his entire life would begin to change, and little by little he would come to a full understanding of his situation, that is to say, of black, of white, of the case, of everything that concerns him. But lost chances are as much a part of life as chances taken, and a story cannot dwell on what might have been. Throwing the book aside in disgust, Blue puts on his coat, for it is fall now, and goes out for a breath of air. Little does he realize that this is the beginning of the end, for something is about to happen, and once it happens, nothing will ever be the same again. He goes to Manhattan, wandering farther from black than at any time before, venting his frustration in movement, hoping to calm himself down by exhausting his body. He walks north, alone in his thoughts, not bothering to take in the things around him. On East 26th Street, his left shoelace comes undone, and it is precisely then, as he bends down to tie it, crouching on one knee, that the sky falls on top of him. For who should he glimpse at just that moment but the future Mrs. Blue? She is coming up the street with her two arms linked through the right arm of a man Blue has never seen before, and she is smiling radiantly, engrossed in what the man is saying to her. For several moments, Blue is so at a loss that he doesn't know whether to bend his head farther down and hide his face or stand up and greet the woman whom he now understands with a knowledge as sudden and irrevocable as the slamming of a door will never be his wife. As it turns out, he manages neither, first ducking his head, but then discovering a second later that he wants her to recognize him. And when he sees she will not, being so wrapped up in her companion's talk, Blue abruptly rises from the pavement when they are no more than 6 feet away from him. It is as though some specter has suddenly materialized in front of her, and the ex-future Mrs. Blue gives out a little gasp, even before she sees who the specter is. Blue speaks her name, in a voice that seems strange to him, and she stops dead in her tracks. Her face registers the shock of seeing Blue, and then, rapidly, her expression turns to one of anger. "You!" she says to him. "You!" Before he has a chance to say a word, she disentangles herself from her companion's arm and begins pounding Blue's chest with her fists, screaming insanely at him, accusing him of one foul crime after another. It is all Blue can do to repeat her name over and over, as though trying desperately to distinguish between the woman he loves and the wild beast who is now attacking him. He feels totally defenseless. And as the onslaught continues, he begins to welcome each new blow as just punishment for his behavior. The other man soon puts a stop to it, however, and though Blue is tempted to take a swing at him, he is too stunned to act quickly enough. And before he knows it, the man has led away the weeping ex-future Mrs. Blue down the street and around the corner. And that's the end of it. This brief scene, so unexpected and devastating, turns Blue inside out. By the time he regains his composure and manages to return home, he realizes that he has thrown away his life. "It's not her fault," he says to himself, wanting to blame her but knowing he can't. He might have been dead for all she knew, and how can he hold it against her for wanting to live? Blue feels tears forming in his eyes, but more than grief, he feels anger at himself for being such a fool. He has lost whatever chance he might have had for happiness. And if that is the case, then it would not be wrong to say that this is truly the beginning of the end. Blue gets back to his room on Orange Street, lies down on his bed, and tries to weigh the possibilities. Eventually, he turns his face to the wall and encounters the photograph of the coroner from Philadelphia, Gold. He thinks of the sad blankness of the unsolved case, the child lying in his grave with no name. And as he studies the death mask of the little boy, he begins to turn an idea over in his mind. Perhaps there are ways of getting close to Black, he thinks, ways that need not give him away. God knows there must be. Moves that can be made, plans that can be set in motion, perhaps two or three at the same time. Never mind the rest, he tells himself. It's time to turn the page. His next report is due the day after tomorrow, and so he sits down to it now in order to get it mailed off on schedule. For the past few months, his reports have been exceedingly cryptic, no more than a paragraph or two, giving the bare bones and nothing else. And this time, he does not depart from the pattern. However, at the bottom of the page, he interjects an obscure comment as a kind of test, hoping to elicit something more than silence from White. Black seems ill. I'm afraid he might be dying. Then he seals up the report, saying to himself that this is only the beginning. 2 days hence, Blue hastens early in the morning to the Brooklyn Post Office, a great castle of a building within eyeshot of the Manhattan Bridge. All of Blue's reports have been addressed to box number 1001, and he walks over to it now as though by accident, sauntering past it and unobtrusively peeking inside to see if the report has come. It has. Or at least a letter is there, a solitary white envelope tilted at a 45-degree angle in the narrow cubby. And Blue has no reason to suspect it's any letter other than his own. He then begins a slow, circular walk around the area, determined to remain until White or someone working for White appears, his eyes fixed on the huge wall of numbered boxes, each box with a different combination, each one holding a different secret. People come and go, open boxes and close them, and Blue keeps wandering in his circle, pausing every now and then in some random spot and then moving on. Everything seems brown to him, as though the fall weather outside has penetrated the room, and the place smells pleasantly of cigar smoke. After several hours, he begins to get hungry, but he does not give in to the call of his stomach, telling himself it's now or never, and therefore holding his ground. Blue watches everyone who approaches the bank of post boxes, zeroing in on each person who skirts the vicinity of 1001, aware of the fact that if it's not White who comes for the reports, it could be anyone, an old woman, a young child, and consequently he must take nothing for granted. But none of these possibilities comes to anything, for the box remains untouched throughout. And though Blue momentarily and successfully spins a story for each candidate who comes near, trying to imagine how that person might be connected to White and or Black, what role he or she might play in the case, and so on, one by one he is forced to dismiss them from his mind, casting them back into the oblivion from which they have come. Just past noon, at a moment when the post office begins to get crowded, an influx of people on their lunch break rushing through to mail letters, buy stamps, attend to business of one sort or another, a man with a mask on his face walks through the door. Blue doesn't notice him at first, what with so many others coming through the door at the same time, but as the man separates himself from the crowd and begins walking toward the numbered post boxes, Blue finally catches sight of the mask. A mask of the sort that children wear on Halloween, made of rubber and portraying some hideous monster with gashes in his forehead and bleeding eyeballs and fangs for teeth. The rest of him is perfectly ordinary, gray tweed overcoat, red scarf wrapped around his neck, and Blue senses in this first moment that the man behind the mask is White. As the man continues walking toward the area of Box 1001, this sense grows to conviction. At the same time, Blue also feels that the man is not really there, that even though he knows he is seeing him, it is more than likely that he is the only one who can. On this point, however, Blue is wrong. For as the masked man continues moving across the vast marble floor, Blue sees a number of people laughing and pointing at him. But whether this is better or worse, he cannot say. The masked man reaches box 1001, spins the combination wheel back and forth and back again, and opens the box. As soon as Blue sees that this is definitely his man, he begins making a move toward him, not really sure of what he is planning to do, but in the back of his mind no doubt intending to grab hold of him and tear the mask off his face. But the man is too alert, and once he has pocketed the envelope and locked the box, he gives a quick glance around the room, sees Blue approaching, and makes a dash for it, heading for the door as fast as he can. Blue runs after him, hoping to catch him from behind and tackle him, but he gets tangled momentarily in a crowd of people at the door, and by the time he manages to get through it, the masked man is bounding down the stairs, landing on the sidewalk, and running down the street. Blue continues in pursuit, even feels he is gaining ground, but then the man reaches the corner, where a bus just happens to be pulling out from a stop, and so he conveniently leaps aboard, and Blue is left in the lurch, all out of breath and standing there like an idiot. 2 days later, when Blue receives his check in the mail, there is finally a word from White. "No more funny business," it says. And though it's not much of a word, for all that, Blue is glad to have received it, happy to have cracked White's wall of silence at last. It's not clear to him, however, whether the message refers to the last report or to the incident in the post office. After thinking it over for a while, he decides that it makes no difference. One way or another, the key to the case is action. He must go on disrupting things wherever he can, a little here, a little there, chipping away at each conundrum until the whole structure begins to weaken, until one day the whole rotten business comes toppling to the ground. Over the next few weeks, Blue returns to the post office several times, hoping to catch another glimpse of White, but nothing comes of it. Either the report is already gone from the box when he gets there, or White does not show up. The fact that this area of the post office is open 24 hours a day leaves Blue with few options. White is on to him now, and he will not make the same mistake twice. He will simply wait until Blue is gone before going to the box, and unless Blue is willing to spend his entire life in the post office, there's no way he can expect to sneak up on White again. The picture is far more complicated than Blue ever imagined. For almost a year now, he has thought of himself as essentially free. For better or worse, he has been doing his job, looking straight ahead of him and studying black, waiting for a possible opening, trying to stick with it. But through it all, he has not given a single thought to what might be going on behind him. Now, after the incident with the masked man and the further obstacles that have ensued, Blue no longer knows what to think. It seems perfectly plausible to him that he is also being watched, observed by another in the same way that he has been observing Black. If that is the case, then he has never been free. From the very start, he has been the man in the middle, thwarted in front and hemmed in on the rear. Oddly enough, this thought reminds him of some sentences from Walden, and he searches through his notebook for the exact phrasing, fairly certain that he has written them down. "We are not where we are," he finds, "but in a false position. Through an infirmity of our natures, we suppose a case and put ourselves into it, and hence are in two cases at the same time, and it is doubly difficult to get out." This makes sense to Blue. And though he is beginning to feel a little frightened, he thinks that perhaps it is not too late for him to do something about it. The real problem boils down to identifying the nature of the problem itself. To start with, who poses the greater threat to him, White or Black? White has kept up his end of the bargain. The checks have come on time every week, and to turn against him now, Blue knows, would be to bite the hand that feeds him. And yet, White is the one who set the case in motion, thrusting Blue into an empty room as it were, and then turning off the light and locking the door. Ever since, Blue has been groping about in the darkness, feeling blindly for the light switch, a prisoner of the case itself. All well and good, but why would White do such a thing? When Blue comes up against this question, he can no longer think. His brain stops working. He can get no farther than this. Take Black, then. Until now, he has been the entire case, the apparent cause of all his troubles. But if White is really out to get Blue and not Black, then perhaps Black has nothing to do with it. Perhaps he is no more than an innocent bystander. In that case, it is Black who occupies the position Blue has assumed all along to be his, and Blue who takes the role of Black. There is something to be said for this. On the other hand, it is also possible that Black is somehow working in league with White, and that together they have conspired to do Blue in. If so, what are they doing to him? Nothing very terrible, finally. At least not in any absolute sense. They have trapped Blue into doing nothing, into being so inactive as to reduce his life to almost no life at all. Yes, says Blue to himself, that's what it feels like nothing at all. He feels like a man who has been condemned to sit in a room and go on reading a book for the rest of his life. This is strange enough. To be only half alive at best, seeing the world only through words, living only through the lives of others. But if the book were an interesting one, perhaps it wouldn't be so bad. He could get caught up in the story, so to speak, and little by little begin to forget himself. But this book offers him nothing. There is no story, no plot, no action. Nothing but a man sitting alone in a room and writing a book. That's all there is, Blue realizes, and he no longer wants any part of it. But how to get out? How to get out of the room that is the book that will go on being written for as long as he stays in the room? As for Black, the so-called writer of this book, Blue can no longer trust what he sees. Is it possible that there really is such a man who does nothing? Who merely sits in his room and writes? Blue has followed him everywhere, has tracked him down into the remotest corners, has watched him so hard that his eyes seem to be failing him. Even when he does leave his room, Black never goes anywhere, never does much of anything, grocery shopping, an occasional haircut, a trip to the movies, and so on. But mostly he just wanders around the streets, looking at odd bits of scenery, clusters of random data, and even this happens only in spurts. For a while it will be buildings, craning his neck to catch a glimpse of the roofs, inspecting doorways, running his hand slowly over the stone facades. And then for a week or two it will be public statues, or the boats in the river, or the signs in the street. Nothing more than that. With scarcely a word to anyone, and no meetings with others except for that one lunch with the woman in tears by now so long ago. In one sense, Blue knows everything there is to know about Black. What kind of soap he buys, what newspapers he reads, what clothes he wears, and each of these things he has faithfully recorded in his notebook. He has learned 1,000 facts. But the only thing they have taught him is that he knows nothing. For the fact remains that none of this is possible. It is not possible for such a man as Black to exist. Consequently, Blue begins to suspect that Black is no more than a ruse, another one of White's hirelings, paid by the week to sit in that room and do nothing. Perhaps all that writing is merely a sham. Page after page of it, a list of every name in the phone book, for example, or each word from the dictionary in alphabetical order, or a handwritten copy of Walden. Or perhaps they are not even words, but senseless scribbles, random marks of a pen, a growing heap of nonsense and confusion. This would make White the real writer then, and Black no more than his stand-in, a fake, an actor with no substance of his own. Then there are the times, following through with this thought, that Blue believes the only logical explanation is that Black is not one man, but several. 2, 3, 4 lookalikes who play the role of Black for Blue's benefit, each one putting in his allotted time and then going back to the comforts of hearth and home. But this is a thought too monstrous for Blue to contemplate for very long. Months go by, and at last he says to himself out loud, "I can't breathe anymore. This is the end. I'm dying." It is midsummer, 1948. Finally, mustering the courage to act, Blue reaches into his bag of disguises and casts about for a new identity. After dismissing several possibilities, he settles on an old man who used to beg on the corners of his neighborhood when he was a boy, a local character by the name of Jimmy Rose, and decks himself out in the garb of tramphood, tattered woolen clothes, shoes held together with string to prevent the soles from flapping, a weathered carpet bag to hold his belongings, and then, last of all, a flowing white beard and long white hair. These final details give him the look of an Old Testament prophet. Blue, as Jimmy Rose, is not a scrofulous down-and-outer so much as a wise fool, a saint of penury, living in the margins of society. A trifle daft, perhaps, but harmless. He exudes a sweet indifference to the world around him, for since everything has happened to him already, nothing can disturb him anymore. Blue posts himself in a suitable spot across the street, takes a fragment of a broken magnifying glass from his pocket, and begins reading a crumpled day-old newspaper that he has salvaged from one of the nearby garbage cans. 2 hours later, Black appears, walking down the steps of his house and then turning in Blue's direction. Black pays no attention to the bum, either lost in his own thoughts or ignoring him on purpose. And so, as he begins to approach, Blue addresses him in a pleasant voice. "Can you spare some change, mister?" Black stops, looks over the disheveled creature who has just spoken, and gradually relaxes into a smile as he realizes he is not in danger. Then he reaches into his pocket, pulls out a coin, and puts it in Blue's hand. "Here you are," he says. "God bless you," says Blue. "Thank you," answers Black, touched by the sentiment. "Never fear," says Blue. "God blesses all." And with that word of reassurance, Black tips his hat to Blue and continues on his way. The next afternoon, once again in bum's regalia, Blue waits for Black in the same spot. Determined to keep the conversation going a little longer this time, now that he has won Black's confidence, Blue finds that the problem is taken out of his hands when Black himself shows an eagerness to linger. It is late in the day by now, not yet dusk, but no longer afternoon, the twilight hour of slow changes, of glowing bricks and shadows. After greeting the bum cordially and giving him another coin, Black hesitates a moment, as though debating whether to take the plunge, and then says, "Has anyone ever told you that you look just like Walt Whitman?"
"Walt who?" answers Blue, remembering to play his part.
"Walt Whitman, a famous poet."
"No," says Blue, "I can't say I know him."
"You wouldn't know him," says Black. "He's not alive anymore, but the resemblance is remarkable."
"Well, you know what they say," says Blue. "Every man has his double somewhere. I don't see why mine can't be a dead man."
"The funny thing," continues Black, "is that Walt Whitman used to work on this street. He printed his first book right here, not far from where we're standing."
"You don't say," says Blue, shaking his head pensively. "It makes you stop and think, doesn't it?"
"There are some odd stories about Whitman," Black says, gesturing to Blue to sit down on the stoop of the building behind them, which he does, and then Black does the same. And suddenly, it's just the two of them out there in the summer light together, chatting away like two old friends about this and that. "Yes," says Black, settling in comfortably to the languor of the moment. "A number of very curious stories. The one about Whitman's brain, for example. All his life, Whitman believed in the science of phrenology, you know, reading the bumps on the skull. It was very popular at the time."
"Can't say I've ever heard of it," replies Blue.
"Well, that doesn't matter," says Black. "The main thing is that Whitman was interested in brains and skulls, thought they could tell you everything about a man's character. Anyway, when Whitman lay dying over there in New Jersey about 50 or 60 years ago, he agreed to let them perform an autopsy on him after he was dead."
"How could he agree to it after he was dead?"
"Ah, good point. I didn't say it right. He was still alive when he agreed. He just wanted them to know that he didn't mind if they opened him up later, what you might call his dying wish.
Famous last words."
"That's right. A lot of people thought he was a genius, you see, and they wanted to take a look at his brain to find out if there was anything special about it. So the day after he died, a doctor removed Whitman's brain, cut it right out of his head, and had it sent to the American Anthropometric Society to be measured and weighed."
"Like a giant cauliflower," interjects Blue.
"Exactly. Like a big gray vegetable. But this is where the story gets interesting. The brain arrives at the laboratory, and just as they're about to get to work on it, one of the assistants drops it on the floor."
"Did it break?"
"Of course it broke. A brain isn't very tough, you know. It splattered all over the place, and that was that. The brain of America's greatest poet got swept up and thrown out with the garbage." Blue, remembering to respond in character, emits several wheezing laughs, a good imitation of an old codger's mirth. Black laughs, too, and by now the atmosphere is thawed to such an extent that no one could ever know they were not lifelong chums. "It's sad to think of poor Walt lying in his grave, though," says Black, "all alone and without any brains."
"Just like that scarecrow," says Blue.
"Sure enough," says Black, "just like the scarecrow in the Land of Oz." After another good laugh, Black says, "And then there's the story of the time Thoreau came to visit Whitman. That's a good one, too."
"Was he another poet?"
"Not exactly, but a great writer just the same. He's the one who lived alone in the woods."
"Oh, yes," says Blue, not wanting to carry his ignorance too far. "Someone once told me about him. Very fond of nature he was. Is that the man you mean?"
"Precisely," answers Black. "Henry David Thoreau. He came down from Massachusetts for a little while and paid a call on Whitman in Brooklyn. But the day before that, he came right here to Orange Street."
"Any particular reason?"
"Plymouth Church. He wanted to hear Henry Ward Beecher's sermon."
"A lovely spot," says Blue, thinking of the pleasant hours he has spent in the grassy yard. "I like to go there myself."
"Many great men have gone there," says Black. "Abraham Lincoln, Charles Dickens. They all walked down this street and went into the church."
"Ghosts."
"Yes, there are ghosts all around us."
"And the story?"
"It's really very simple. Thoreau and Bronson Alcott, a friend of his, arrived at Whitman's house on Myrtle Avenue, and Walt's mother sent them up to the attic bedroom he shared with his mentally retarded brother, Eddie. Everything was just fine. They shook hands, exchanged greetings, and so on. But then, when they sat down to discuss their views of life, Thoreau and Alcott noticed a full chamber pot right in the middle of the floor. Walt was, of course, an expansive fellow and paid no attention, but the two New Englanders found it hard to keep talking with a bucket of excrement in front of them. So eventually they went downstairs to the parlor and continued the conversation there. It's a minor detail, I realize. But still, when two great writers meet, history is made, and it's important to get all the facts straight. That chamber pot, you see, somehow reminds me of the brains on the floor. And when you stop to think about it, there's a certain similarity of form. The bumps and convolutions, I mean. There's a definite connection. brains and guts, the insides of a man. We always talk about trying to get inside a writer to understand his work better. But when you get right down to it, there's not much to find in there. At least not much that's different from what you'd find in anyone else.
You seem to know a lot about these things, says Blue, who's beginning to lose the thread of Black's argument.
It's my hobby, says Black. I like to know how writers live, especially American writers. It helps me to understand things.
I see, says Blue, who sees nothing at all, for with each word Black speaks, he finds himself understanding less and less.
Take Hawthorne, says Black, a good friend of Thoreau's and probably the first real writer America ever had. After he graduated from college, he went back to his mother's house in Salem, shut himself up in his room, and didn't come out for 12 years.
What did he do in there?
He wrote stories.
Is that all? He just wrote?
Writing is a solitary business. It takes over your life. In some sense, a writer has no life of his own. Even when he's there, he's not really there.
Another ghost.
Exactly.
Sounds mysterious.
It is. But Hawthorne wrote great stories, you see, and we still read them now, more than 100 years later. In one of them, a man named Wakefield decides to play a joke on his wife. He tells her that he has to go away on a business trip for a few days, but instead of leaving the city, he goes around the corner, rents a room, and just waits to see what will happen. He can't say for sure why he's doing it, but he does it just the same. 3 or 4 days go by, but he doesn't feel ready to return home yet, and so he stays on in the rented room. The days turn into weeks. The weeks turn into months. One day, Wakefield walks down his old street and sees his house decked out in mourning. It's his own funeral, and his wife has become a lonely widow. Years go by. Every now and then he crosses paths with his wife in town, and once, in the middle of a large crowd, he actually brushes up against her. But she doesn't recognize him. More years pass, more than 20 years, and little by little Wakefield has become an old man. One rainy night in autumn, as he's taking a walk through the empty streets, he happens to pass by his old house and peeks through the window. There's a nice warm fire burning in the fireplace, and he thinks to himself, how pleasant it would be if I were in there right now, sitting in one of those cozy chairs by the hearth, instead of standing out here in the rain. And so, without giving it any more thought than that, he walks up the steps of the house and knocks on the door.
And then?
That's it. That's the end of the story. The last thing we see is the door opening and Wakefield going inside with a crafty smile on his face.
And we never know what he says to his wife?
No, that's the end, not another word. But he moved in again, we know that much, and remained a loving spouse until death. By now, the sky has begun to darken overhead, and night is fast approaching. A last glimmer of pink remains in the west, but the day is as good as done. Black, taking his cue from the darkness, stands up from his spot and extends his hand to Blue. It's been a pleasure talking to you, he says. I had no idea we'd been sitting here so long.
The pleasure's been mine, says Blue, relieved that the conversation is over, for he knows that it won't be long now before his beard begins to slip, what with the summer heat and his nerves making him perspire into the glue.
My name is Black, says Black, shaking Blue's hand.
Mine's Jimmy, says Blue. Jimmy Rose.
I'll remember this little talk of ours for a long time, Jimmy, says Black.
I will too, says Blue. You've given me a lot to think about.
God bless you, Jimmy Rose, says Black.
And God bless you, sir, says Blue.
And then, with one last handshake, they walk off in opposite directions, each one accompanied by his own thoughts. Later that night, when Blue returns to his room, he decides that he had best bury Jimmy Rose now, get rid of him for good. The old tramp has served his purpose, but beyond this point, it would not be wise to go. Blue is glad to have made this initial contact with Black, but the encounter did not quite have its desired effect, and all in all, he feels rather shaken by it. For even though the talk had nothing to do with the case, Blue cannot help feeling that Black was actually referring to it all along, talking in riddles, so to speak, as though trying to tell Blue something, but not daring to say it out loud. Yes, Black was more than friendly. His manner was altogether pleasant, but still, Blue cannot get rid of the thought that the man was on to him from the start. If so, then Black is surely one of the conspirators. For why else would he have gone on talking to Blue as he did? Not from loneliness, certainly. Assuming that Black is for real, then loneliness cannot be an issue. Everything about his life to this point has been part of a determined plan to remain alone, and it would be absurd to read his willingness to talk as an effort to escape the throes of solitude. Not at this late date, not after more than a year of avoiding all human contact. If Black is finally resolved to break out of his hermetic routine, then why would he begin by talking to a broken-down old man on a street corner? No, Black knew that he was talking to Blue, and if he knew that, then he knows who Blue is. No two ways about it, Blue says to himself. He knows everything. When the time comes for him to write his next report, Blue is forced to confront this dilemma. White never said anything about making contact with Black. Blue was to watch him, no more, no less. And he wonders now if he has not in fact broken the rules of his assignment. If he includes the conversation in his report, then White might object. On the other hand, if he does not put it in, and if Black is indeed working with White, then White will know immediately that Blue is lying. Blue mulls this over for a long time. But for all that, he gets no closer to finding a solution. He's stuck, one way or the other, and he knows it. In the end, he decides to leave it out, but only because he still puts some meager hope in the fact that he has guessed wrong and that White and Black are not in it together. But this last little stab at optimism soon comes to naught. 3 weeks after sending in the sanitized report, his weekly check comes in the mail, and inside the envelope there is also a note that says, "Why do you lie?" And then Blue has proof, beyond any shadow of a doubt. And from that moment on, Blue lives with the knowledge that he is drowning. The next night, he follows Black into Manhattan on the subway, dressed in his normal clothes, no longer feeling he has to hide anything. Black gets off at Times Square and wanders around for a while in the bright lights, the noise, the crowds of people surging this way and that. Blue, watching him as though his life depended on it, is never more than 3 or 4 steps behind him. At 9 o'clock, Black enters the lobby of the Algonquin Hotel, and Blue follows him in. There's quite a crowd milling about, and tables are scarce. So, when Black sits down in a corner nook that just that moment has become free, it seems perfectly natural for Blue to approach and politely ask if he can join him. Black has no objection, and gestures with an indifferent shrug of the shoulders for Blue to take the chair opposite. For several minutes, they say nothing to each other, waiting for someone to take their orders, in the meantime watching the women walk by in their summer dresses, inhaling the different perfumes that flit behind them in the air. And Blue feels no rush to jump into things, content to bide his time and let the business take its course. When the waiter at last comes to ask their pleasure, Black orders a black and white on the rocks. And Blue cannot help but take this as a secret message that the fun is about to begin, all the while marveling at Black's effrontery, his crassness, his vulgar obsession. For the sake of symmetry, Blue orders the same drink. As he does so, he looks Black in the eyes, but Black gives nothing away, looking back at Blue with utter blankness, dead eyes that seem to say there is nothing behind them, and that no matter how hard Blue looks, he will never find a thing. This gambit nevertheless breaks the ice, and they begin by discussing the merits of various brands of scotch. Plausibly enough, one thing leads to another, and as they sit there chatting about the inconveniences of the New York summer season, the decor of the hotel, the Algonquin Indians who lived in the city long ago, when it was all woods and fields, Blue slowly evolves into the character he wants to play for the night, settling on a jovial blowhard by the name of Snow, a life insurance salesman from Kenosha, Wisconsin. Play dumb, Blue tells himself, for he knows that it would make no sense to reveal who he is, even though he knows that Black knows. It's got to be hide and seek, he says. Hide and seek to the end. They finish their first drink and order another round, followed by yet another. And as the talk ambles from actuarial tables to the life expectancies of men in different professions, Black lets fall a remark that turns the conversation in another direction. I suppose I wouldn't be very high up on your list, he says. Oh, says Blue, having no idea what to expect. What kind of work do you do? I'm a private detective, says Black, point blank, all cool and collected. And for a brief moment, Blue is tempted to throw his drink in Black's face. He's that peeved, that burned at the man's gall. You don't say, Blue exclaims, quickly recovering and managing to feign a bumpkin's surprise. A private detective. Imagine that, in the flesh. Just think of what the wife will say when I tell her. Me in New York having drinks with a private eye. She'll never believe it. What I'm trying to say, says Black rather abruptly, is that I don't imagine my life expectancy is very great. At least not according to your statistics. Probably not, Blue blusters on. But think of the excitement. There's more to life than living a long time, you know. Half the men in America would give 10 years off their retirement to live the way you do, cracking cases, living by your wits, seducing women, pumping bad guys full of lead. God, there's a lot to be said for it. That's all make-believe, says Black. Real detective work can be pretty dull. Well, every job has its routines, Blue continues, but in your case, at least you know that all the hard work will eventually lead to something out of the ordinary. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, but most of the time it's no. Take the case I'm working on now. I've been at it for more than a year already, and nothing could be more boring. I'm so bored that sometimes I think I'm losing my mind. How so? Well, figure it out for yourself. My job is to watch someone, no one in particular as far as I can tell, and send in a report about him every week. Just that. Watch this guy and write about it. Not one damned thing more. What's so terrible about that? He doesn't do anything, that's what. He just sits in his room all day and writes. It's enough to drive you crazy. It could be that he's leading you along. You know, lulling you to sleep before springing into action? That's what I thought at first, but now I'm sure that nothing's going to happen. Not ever. I can feel it in my bones. That's too bad, says Blue sympathetically. Maybe you should resign from the case. I'm thinking about it. I'm also thinking that maybe I should just chuck the whole business and go into something else, some other line of work. Sell insurance, maybe, or run off to join the circus. I never realized it could get as bad as that, says Blue, shaking his head. But tell me, why aren't you watching your man now? Shouldn't you be keeping an eye on him? That's just the point, answers Black. I don't even have to bother anymore. I've been watching him for so long now that I know him better than I know myself. All I have to do is think about him, and I know what he's doing. I know where he is. I know everything. It's come to the point that I can watch him with my eyes closed. Do you know where he is now? At home, the same as usual, sitting in his room and writing. What's he writing about? I'm not sure, but I have a pretty good idea. I think he's writing about himself, the story of his life. That's the only possible answer. Nothing else would fit.
So why all the mystery?
I don't know, says Black. And for the first time, his voice betrays some emotion, catching ever so slightly on the words.
It all boils down to one question then, doesn't it? Says Blue,
forgetting all about Snow now and looking Black straight in the eyes. Does he know you're watching him or not? Black turns away, unable to look at Blue anymore, and says with a suddenly trembling voice,
Of course he knows. That's the whole point, isn't it? He's got to know, or else nothing makes sense.
Why?
Because he needs me, says Black, still looking away. He needs my eyes looking at him. He needs me to prove he's alive.
Blue sees a tear fall down Black's cheek. But before he can say anything, before he can begin to press home his advantage, Black stands up hastily and excuses himself, saying that he has to make a telephone call. Blue waits in his chair for 10 or 15 minutes, but he knows that he's wasting his time. Black won't be back. The conversation is over, and no matter how long he sits there, nothing more will happen tonight. Blue pays for the drinks and then heads back to Brooklyn. As he turns down Orange Street, he looks up at Black's window and sees that everything is dark.
No matter, says Blue. He'll return before long. We haven't come to the end yet. The party is only beginning. Wait until the champagne is opened, and then we'll see what's what.
Once inside, Blue paces back and forth, trying to plot his next move. It seems to him that Black has finally made a mistake. But he is not quite certain, for in spite of the evidence, Blue cannot shrug the feeling that it was all done on purpose, and that Black has now begun to call out to him, leading him along, so to speak, urging him on towards whatever end he is planning. Still, he has broken through to something, and for the first time since the case began, he is no longer standing where he was. Ordinarily, Blue would be celebrating this little triumph of his, but it turns out he is in no mood for patting himself on the back tonight. More than anything else, he feels sad. He feels drained of enthusiasm. He feels disappointed in the world. Somehow, the facts have finally let him down, and he finds it hard not to take it personally, knowing full well that however he might present the case to himself, he is a part of it, too. Then he walks to the window, looks out across the street, and sees that the lights are now on in Black's room. He lies down on his bed and thinks, Goodbye, Mr. White. You were never really there, were you? There never was such a man as White. And then, poor Black, poor soul, poor blighted no one. And then, as his eyes grow heavy and sleep begins to wash over him, he thinks how strange it is that everything has its own color. Everything we see, everything we touch, everything in the world has its own color. Struggling to stay awake a little longer, he begins to make a list. Take Blue, for example, he says. There are blue birds and blue jays and blue herons. There are cornflowers and periwinkles. There is noon over New York. There are blueberries, huckleberries, and the Pacific Ocean. There are blue devils and blue ribbons and blue bloods. There is a voice singing the blues. There is my father's police uniform. There are blue laws and blue movies. There are my eyes and my name. He pauses, suddenly at a loss for more blue things, and then moves on to White. There are seagulls, he says, and terns, and storks, and cockatoos. There are the walls of this room and the sheets on my bed. There are lilies of the valley, carnations, and the petals of daisies. There is the flag of peace and Chinese death. There is mother's milk and semen. There are my teeth. There are the whites of my eyes. There are white bass and white pines and white ants. There is the president's house and white rot. There are white lies and white heat. Then, without hesitating, he moves on to black, beginning with black books, the black market, and the black hand. "There is night over New York," he says. "There are the Chicago Black Sox. There are blackberries and crows, blackouts and black marks, Black Tuesday and the Black Death. There is blackmail. There is my hair. There is the ink that comes out of a pen. There is the world a blind man sees." Then, finally growing tired of the game, he begins to drift, saying to himself that there is no end to it. He falls asleep, dreams of things that happened long ago, and then, in the middle of the night, wakes up suddenly and begins pacing the room again, thinking about what he will do next. Morning comes, and Blue starts busying himself with another disguise. This time, it's the Fuller Brush Man, a trick he has used before, and for the next 2 hours he patiently goes about giving himself a bald head, a mustache, and age lines around his eyes and mouth, sitting in front of his little mirror like an old-time vaudevillian on tour. Shortly after 11 o'clock, he gathers up his case of brushes and walks across the street to Black's building. Picking the lock on the front door is child's play for Blue, no more than a matter of seconds, and as he slips into the hallway, he can't help feeling something of the old thrill. "No tough stuff," he reminds himself, as he starts climbing the stairs to Black's floor. This visit is only to get a look inside, to stake out the room for future reference. Still, there's an excitement to the moment that Blue can't quite suppress, for it's more than just seeing the room, he knows. It's the thought of being there himself, of standing inside those four walls, of breathing the same air as Black. "From now on," he thinks, "everything that happens will affect everything else. The door will open, and after that, Black will be inside of him forever." He knocks. The door opens, and suddenly there is no more distance. The thing and the thought of the thing are one and the same. Then it's Black who is there, standing in the doorway with an uncapped fountain pen in his right hand, as though interrupted in his work, and yet with a look in his eyes that tells Blue he's been expecting him, resigned to the hard truth, but no longer seeming to care. Blue launches into his patter about the brushes, pointing to the case, offering apologies, asking admittance, all in the same breath, with that rapid salesman's pitch he's done 1,000 times before. Black calmly lets him in, saying he might be interested in a toothbrush. And as Blue steps across the sill, he goes rattling on about hairbrushes and clothes brushes, anything to keep the words flowing, for in that way he can leave the rest of himself free to take in the room, observe the observable, think, all the while diverting Black from his true purpose. The room is much as he imagined it would be, though perhaps even more austere. Nothing on the walls, for example, which surprises him a little, since he always thought there would be a picture or two, an image of some kind just to break the monotony, a nature scene perhaps, or else a portrait of someone Black might once have loved. Blue was always curious to know what the picture would be, thinking it might be a valuable clue. But now that he sees there is nothing, he understands that this is what he should have expected all along. Other than that, there's precious little to contradict his former notions. It's the same monk's cell he saw in his mind. The small, neatly made bed in one corner, the kitchenette in another corner, everything spotless, not a crumb to be seen. Then, in the center of the room, facing the window, the wooden table with a single, stiff-backed wooden chair, pencils, pens, a typewriter, a bureau, a night table, a lamp, a bookcase on the north wall, but no more than several books in it, Walden, Leaves of Grass, Twice Told Tales, a few others. No telephone, no radio, no magazines. On the table, neatly stacked around the edges, piles of paper, some blank, some written on, some typed, some in longhand, hundreds of pages, perhaps thousands. "But you can't call this a life," thinks Blue. "You can't really call it anything. It's a no man's land. the place you come to at the end of the world. They look through the toothbrushes, and Black finally chooses a red one. From there, they start examining the various clothes brushes, with Blue giving demonstrations on his own suit. "For a man as neat as yourself," says Blue, "I should think you'd find it indispensable." But Black says he's managed so far without one. On the other hand, maybe he'd like to consider a hairbrush. And so they go through the possibilities in the sample case, discussing the different sizes and shapes, the different kinds of bristles, and so on. Blue is already done with his real business, of course, but he goes through the motions nevertheless, wanting to do the things right, even if it doesn't matter. Still, after Black has paid for the brushes, and Blue is packing up his case to go, he can't resist making one little remark. "You seem to be a writer," he says, gesturing to the table, and Black says, "Yes, that's right, he's a writer." "It looks like a big book," Blue continues. "Yes," says Black, "I've been working on it for many years." "Are you almost finished?" "I'm getting there," Black says thoughtfully. "But sometimes it's hard to know where you are. I think I'm almost done, and then I realize I've left out something important, and so I have to go back to the beginning again. But yes, I do dream of finishing it one day. One day soon, perhaps." "I hope I get a chance to read it," says Blue. "Anything is possible," says Black. "But first of all, I've got to finish it. There are days when I don't even know if I'll live that long." "Well, we never know, do we?" says Blue, nodding philosophically. "One day we're alive and the next day we're dead. It happens to all of us." "Very true," says Black. "It happens to all of us." They're standing by the door now, and something in Blue wants to go on making inane remarks of this sort. Playing the buffoon is enjoyable, he realizes. But at the same time, there's an urge to toy with Black, to prove that nothing has escaped him. For deep down, Blue wants Black to know that he's just as smart as he is, that he can match wits with him every step of the way. But Blue manages to fight back the impulse and hold his tongue, nodding politely in thanks for the sales, and then makes his exit. That's the end of the Fuller Brush Man, and less than an hour later he is discarded into the same bag that holds the remains of Jimmy Rose. Blue knows that no more disguises will be needed. The next step is inevitable, and the only thing that matters now is to choose the right moment. But 3 nights later, when he finally gets his chance, Blue realizes that he's scared. Black goes out at 9 o'clock, walks down the street, and vanishes around the corner. Although Blue knows that this is a direct signal, that Black is practically begging him to make his move, he also feels that it could be a setup. And now, at the last possible moment, when only just before he was filled with confidence, almost swaggering with a sense of his own power, he sinks into a fresh torment of self-doubt. Why should he suddenly begin to trust Black? What earthly cause could there be for him to think they are both working on the same side now? How has this happened, and why does he find himself so obsequiously at Black's bidding once again?
This is the end of disc number 6. Please insert disc number 7.